Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 259. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, my very good friends, John Lindemann.
Howdy, everybody.
James Jones.
One away from the big 260.
And Greg Leahy.
Oh, hoy, hoy, everyone.
Good to have you back, Greg. Mm. We got some good comments on Chris being on the show last week. No surprise. I mean, he's a grizzled veteran of podcasting.
He's a professional.
That's right. We got commentary like it was good to have somebody who knows what they're talking about on the show. Thanks, you fuckers. Go to hell.
Really quickly, I did want to say that I wish I'd mentioned it when Chris was on the show. I didn't think about it till afterward, but I was listening to 8-4 Play, and in particular, J.J. Epperson, who is Sporsk, who was Sporsk on Gaff before he went to Japan and started working at 8-4, and I remember that J.J. was on the Gaff cast along with Chris Kohler, and that was the first podcast I ever heard that was recorded in Japan in English about Japanese gaming. And Chris was a founding member of that. And 8-4 Play is pretty much the same thing as the Gaff cast, just with a couple different people. But some of the people are even the same. Like when they have CVX Freak on there talking about Resident Evil, I'm pretty sure he was on the Gaff cast. So it's interesting. I've never heard them mention it, but I think Chris is actually one of the sort of grandfathers of the 8-4 Play podcast. And I wish I would have asked him about that. It would have been kind of interesting to hear his take on it. But anyway, let's jump into the news. There has been so much news lately. I feel like we've got to talk about it. Since the last show we recorded, we did have the 3DS conference.
We have done a lot of news the last few weeks.
A lot of news, yes. If you haven't watched the website, definitely go do that. You can catch up on a lot of this stuff.
I mean, on the show, we've been doing a lot of news lately.
Well, it's funny. The 3DS conference that now happened a few days ago had a lot of big bombshells in it, a lot of interesting things that actually sort of came out after the fact, after the conference, when they released press releases and websites and video trailers of things. But they started the show off with a Wii game.
Multiple, actually.
They showed quite a bit of Skyward Sword, including a lot of things that we'd never seen before. There's the stuff about it, Miyamoto claiming that it's between 50 and 100 hours long, that there's some kind of master quest to it, which is really interesting. But for me, there were a couple things just about the connective tissue that we've talked about so many times that's really going to make or break this game. First off, in one of the trailers, I think you get a really clear sense of how the world is put together. You see Link, he's in, you know, the world area that we've kind of seen, the foresty, grassy kind of area. He walks up to some kind of totem or some kind of pillar and checks it, and it asks if he wants to go to the sky. And he does that, and he sort of holds this cloth over his head, not unlike the leaf in Wind Waker. And this gust of wind shoots him way up into the air, and then he's sort of free-falling for a sec, like skydiving. And then his big red bird comes and picks him up, and now he's riding on the bird. And he's riding over, I mean, there's clouds everywhere, but he's also riding over the sky world where he starts out the game that we heard about, the place where he's from. And he can actually fly all over it, and then once he gets over the area that he wants to jump off of, he just jumps off the bird and floats down with his little cloth parachute thing. And then he sort of steers himself down to whatever part of the sky world he wants to go on. So it looks like the bird is indeed definitely involved in navigation and travel, and also that you will be able to freely go back and forth between the sky world and the lower world, whatever that's called. So that was kind of heartening to see to me, because it means that they're going to have to actually put stuff in that will make it worthwhile to be going back and forth. So it kind of speaks to how much exploration there is and how much, you know, freedom of travel there's going to be. And it looks like a very convenient way to kind of get around. So I'm pretty excited about that. You guys have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I wonder whether there'll be portions of the game where you might spend an extended period in one or the other, and then at some point, presumably towards the end of the game, that freedom of travel becomes very much more comprehensive. You know, like, so a bunch of warp points open up to you, and then you can flip back and forth very easily, sort of taking some of the pain out of retraversal. I feel that'll probably be how, you know, at first you won't have that kind of freedom, and it'll become gradually available to you.
Yeah, it seems like something like it would be kind of a carrot that they would put in front of you, and, you know, later on, you know, kind of like you get the airship, so to speak.
Right, exactly. But I mean, if you think about Twilight Princess didn't really have anything like that. I mean, you had the horse from the very beginning, but the areas that the horse could access were walled off by Twilight.
Yeah.
And even then, the world Twilight Princess is not that big.
No, it's really, I mean, I hate to say it, but it's not greatly larger than the N64 games. Well,
you have places like the desert is really big, but it's also segmented from the rest of the world, so it's not contiguous. So this kind of gives me hope that this one might be a little bit more expansive. And Wind Waker's world was expansive, but in a different way, with a lot of empty space in between. So it'd be interesting to see what kind of balance they strike with this. And then the other thing I found was really interesting is there's now an official trailer out in English, actually, explaining the item upgrade system, the crafting system. And this is completely new to Zelda, as far as I can think. I don't think there's really any good...
It is Monster Hunterian.
It is a little bit. I think it looks a lot simpler than...
Well, yeah, it is. But, I mean, if you understand crafting in Monster Hunter, you get the idea.
Sure. And it's in a lot of other games, too. It's a lot much older concept than just Monster Hunter.
Yeah.
The idea is that you kill enemies and they drop little random items. There was actually a bit of this in Wind Waker where enemies dropped items that you could trade.
The necklaces and all that kind of stuff they would drop.
But you didn't take four pig monster necklaces and turn them into a shield.
Right.
Which would be a shitty fucking shield, to be honest.
Instead of trading them or having them qualify you for some kind of prize... You get different combinations of this stuff. It looks like there's quite a few different items you can collect, but also quite a few different items you can upgrade. And you take him to a shop that's up in the Sky World, and he'll upgrade your shield or maybe upgrade your sword or upgrade your slingshot. There were about 10 or 12 item slots there, so it looked like that was the number of different items that you can upgrade. So it looks like it's going to be a pretty extensive feature and a pretty big part of the game. And I thought that was really interesting because it's, again, it's kind of a trope of RPGs, but it's not one that Zelda has ever really used before. So it's one way in which this Zelda game looks like it might be actually a little bit more of an RPG than the series usually goes for. So I thought that was really interesting. I don't know that it's necessarily a good thing, but it's definitely different. And I like to see different.
Well, there's another thing, because the whole thing of shields sort of being consumable, almost, you know, they kind of wear out and stuff. I mean, so there's that. It kind of goes hand in hand with that part of the game that you're going to maybe have to sort of continuously replenish certain elements of your equipment using these things that you get from combating enemies.
Right. That same shop, it's not an upgrade, but the same shop can also has an option to fix your shield. And I don't know to what extent your shield could be degraded or damaged. But that actually goes all the way back to the original Legend of Zelda, when there are those like monsters in the dungeons that can eat your shield and reduce it from the big shield that blocks fireballs down to the little shield that only blocks little rocks from Octoroks.
Jerks.
So the idea of your shield being degraded and you having to pay to get back to the good shield is all the way in the DNA of Zelda. And it actually hasn't been used as much in recent games.
But, I mean, shields were destroyable in Zelda games.
The Deku shield could be burned in Ocarina.
And like could still steal your shield from you.
But usually if you killed them quickly, you could get it back.
Yeah, there were times where it was like, yeah, no, I'm going to keep it. And you were just like, fuck, really? But once you, in the case of Ocarina of Time, once you had the mirror shield, they couldn't keep it because you can't go buy another one.
All right. Well, in summary, Skyward Sword looking more and more interesting. Based on the word of mouth I've heard, I think people are getting a lot more hyped up for it now that they've seen this stuff.
What we haven't talked a whole lot about, though, is that the trailer they showed during the actual event showed a lot of things that Link does that seem to be connected to Motion Plus that we haven't seen before.
Yeah, like walking across a rope.
That's been seen before.
Yeah, that was seen at the very end of that demo that no one was able to get to without playing 30 times. But there were like pieces of interaction with the environment, and then there was some weird thing he was riding on. But there was, it just seemed like they had more ideas than they had shown up until that point of how they want to use Motion Plus. And it seemed like the game felt more thought out than I originally felt about it. Like, they're further along than I thought they are in terms of what ideas they have.
So it's not just Wii Sports Resort ideas recycled for Zelda.
It's not just fencing where you can control your movement. No.
Good.
But I mean, just the diversity in things that Link can do. Not even necessarily just in how they're using the Motion Plus, but the fact that there are things in the environment with which he can interact more so than we've seen up to this point.
And of course, right. I'm always hoping for items that are going to surprise a little when you actually get into the game. You know, something like the examples you'd often quote is like the spinner in Twilight Princess or something, but that gets quoted a lot because it's relatively isolated case.
Yeah.
So with Motion Plus sort of opening up some of these avenues, you'd hope that there are a few more of such examples.
And the spinner gets brought up a lot because it was awesome and also pretty underused.
It was. But you know what? I mean, they've shown the beetle, the flying beetle thing quite a bit.
Well, I mean, remember, the first upgrade you find in the demo was the beetle upgrade.
Yeah, right. You made the beetle
better. It's the upgraded beetle, which makes you wonder, is there more than one upgrade? What, just how much can this thing do? Just how much are we going to be using it? Because that item alone opens up a lot of interesting design in terms of how vertical it can make the game, and you know, all the precarious things of where you're trying to fly through a tight tunnel and it's not allowed to touch the walls, so you have to be real skillful with it.
So the upgrade lets it carry things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess they're going to give it to us at one point and then let us carry stuff with it relatively later, kind of like when we got the second hookshot.
Yeah.
I kind of wish they just let it do that from the start, but whatever.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I mean, they probably don't want to overwhelm you right off the bat, because it's a pretty weird item, but definitely gives me hope that, like Greg said, we're going to get more and more new items that let us do things we haven't done before. That's my general theme on this Zelda game, is I want to do things I haven't done before in Zelda games, and it looks like they're heading in that direction, so I'm pretty happy. Well, we need to move on. We haven't talked about a 3DS game yet from the 3DS conference.
This wasn't actually news. We haven't gotten to the news part yet.
Yeah, so the biggest announcement of the 3DS conference, Monster Hunter 4 is coming to the 3DS. Not just 3G, which was previously revealed by the Famitsu with the cradle thing, but Monster Hunter 4 coming out at some point in the distant future, and that is
2012.
Megaton-rific. Unless Capcom surprises everyone and shows it also for the Vita at TGS, which I don't think is happening.
No,
the Sony have already, someone asked Sony about it and they were just like, oh, you're going to have to ask Capcom about why they put things on whatever systems. You know, they weren't playing coy or anything, so it sounds like...
No, it was more than a no statement. It was kind of like a no goddammit statement.
Like a pissed off sounding, it's not on Vita.
the thing is, my take is that, yeah, Monster Hunter 4 won't, but when they come out with like Monster Hunter 4G
derivative
Freedom Unite, I mean, it'll be out on Vita.
Yeah.
HD portable.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about how this went down, though, because I thought this was relatively interesting. So at no point during the event did we see the cradle thing.
That's right.
Well, the first time it was officially shown was at TGS.
Yeah, with Capcom's booth.
At Capcom.
Very weird.
Yeah, but they did have a trailer. Not a trailer, but there was a website after that was posted about the same time as the 3DS conference that had some information.
There was, yes, but they didn't show it during the event, which was very odd.
Well, that was not unexpected at all. The thing they wanted to do with this press conference, the overarching goal, it's very much what Chris talked about last week before it happened, which was to get in before TGS even starts and sort of stake out that position for the media, for the Japanese media, obviously, considering Western media was excluded, to say, you're going to see all this stuff in a few days, but we're already here and we're big time and we're going to build essentially an unassailable lead in this portable market before the Vita could even get off the ground. And so what you don't want to do in that, and this is something we talked about even before, is kill the momentum that the DS is already building in Japan. You know, they're ticking along at about 50,000 units a week now since the price cut there. And I think if you know, to the broader gaming media that's assembled at that, say, oh, and here's this analog attachment and all the things that kind of implies about what might happen with a revision in the future or whatever, they don't want to put it out there like that.
Especially when it comes out they need a AAA battery.
You want to put that on the down low. So it did not surprise me at all to see it omitted.
It's in tiny font, actually, it mentions the AAA battery, which is kind of amusing. But but I do want to discuss how this went about, though. So they show the Monster Hunter 3G trailer, which is technically the announcement, even though the Famitsu article was already out.
Yeah.
They talk about it a little bit. We find out it's coming out like 2 days before the Vita does.
Actually, more than a week before the Vita.
Is it? I thought, okay.
Yeah, which is, if Monster Hunter 4 wasn't already a nail in the coffin of the Vita, the fact that 3G comes out on 3DS a week before Vita launches is bad news for Sony.
It was
bad
news. I mean, it felt like a deliberate FU move.
It makes me wonder if the Vita might actually end up being more successful in America than it is in Japan, which is kind of hilarious given the way PSP went.
So they showed the trailer, that they talked about it for a while. Of course, it was in Japanese, so we didn't really grasp all the complexities of what they were talking about. And then they showed another Monster Hunter trailer. And it was like, this looks better.
But also, I mean, it looks different. I mean, what you're you don't know what you're watching, because you look at it and it's like, okay, is someone doing the old trademark Monster Hunter high-stepping running or whatever?
Yeah, it was clearly Monster Hunter.
So you know it's Monster, but at the same time, he's running away from one monster and, like, jumping from cliff to cliff. And it's like Monster Hunter meets Uncharted or something. You don't know what you're looking at. And then another monster comes along, and then they're kind of going back and forth. It's just like, what the hell is this? And then at the end, the logo just comes up, Monster Hunter 4. So, yeah, that was a little bit of an adventure they kind of took us on, the way they put that together.
I mean, the fact that they sandwiched the Monster Hunter 3G discussion with two trailers, it felt like, wait, is this what Monster Hunter 3G, they want it to look like? What the hell is this? And then when it came, you're like, oh my God, what did they just pull off?
Yeah.
Because I think in the chat, I said something along the lines of, oh, so that's how they got the second circle pad. Capcom could have come in and said, we want 8 of them. We'll give you Monster Hunter 4 in exchange.
Yeah.
I mean, it was absurd.
So let's talk about the ramifications of this, because none of us are enough of an expert on Monster Hunter to talk about what this means for the series or anything. But what it means for 3DS is that if you're, you know, a European or an American or whatever, sitting at home looking at your 3DS thinking, man, are any third-party games ever going to come out for this thing? Are any games ever going to come out for this? Monster Hunter 4 says yes, and it doesn't matter if you don't give a shit about Monster Hunter. What this means is 3DS wins, and you will have plenty of games out of all your favorite Japanese developers to play on the 3DS, because it's going to be massive in
Japan. It goes back to what Chris said last week, which is that Monster Hunter literally pulled the PSP's ass out of the fire in Japan.
Right. It really did.
The sales are amazing. I think it's sort of like the portable third that we've obviously talked about, you know, it's a sort of derivative of Tri,
right.
But you know, obviously
it lacks like the underwater stuff, and it's like,
I think that's sold, has been on sales since the end of last year, so less than a year. And it sold like 5 million copies. Which is, you know, that's Pokemon type numbers.
Yep.
When the PSP isn't even still, the sales are good, but it still isn't got the user base of a DS for Pokemon Black and White to sell what it sold, for instance. So the scale.
And to be clear, 3G is not just some gimped thing they're throwing out the door to give Sony the bird.
No,
3G is Monster Hunter 3 with a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, so it's going to be a big seller too. It's going to really pave the way.
It's basically like giving them free crack and then charging them $40 for it after the fact. Because they're already going to pay it, because they're already hooked.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's going to buy it. I mean, they buy every single Monster Hunter game that comes out.
They're not going to be able to say, well, I already played Monster Hunter Tri, because it's Tri with more stuff.
So, I mean, I don't give a shit about Monster Hunter 4. I really don't. But what this means is Capcom is bringing all the other games that I do want to play along for the ride. So this means we're going to get Final Fantasies on 3DS. We're going to get Dragon Quest on 3DS. We're going to get Castlevanias and more Metal Gears. And all the stuff that you like out of the Japanese development is going to be on 3DS now.
And
some of it will be on Vita too, but yeah, less of it.
And we actually saw that with the announcements. I mean, obviously this is how they ended the show.
Yeah, it's humongous.
Yeah, but you saw things like Samurai Warriors Versus, which actually looked like a decent game somehow from Tecmo Koei. You saw well, we didn't see Kingdom Hearts 3D, but it's at the show right now.
Actually, there was a few. It was in the Final Fantasy Theatrhythm trailer that they showed after the conference. There is a couple of seconds of someone playing Kingdom Hearts.
Yeah, but I mean during the actual event.
Right. Yeah.
But they showed that other Square Enix game that they say is inspired by both Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy.
Well, hang on. Before you get into all this whole litany of other games that were shown,
okay,
you brought up the expansion circle pad. So let's go over what that actually is, because again, we didn't find out till really after the 3DS conference, but we do have a lot of details on it now. We've got reports from our correspondents at TGS who've actually played with this thing, and we have sent in really close-up photos of it, which
yes,
you can go to the website and check out. I actually really recommend you do that, because I think when you see it from several different angles and really up close, you'll get a much better sense of how big this thing is and what it would actually feel like in your hands.
So real quickly, we knew the buttons before. It adds the extra circle pad. It adds the L buttons.
Yeah, so you have four shoulder buttons all together. But it's funny, when you look at the shoulder button part of it, it actually looks kind of like the top of a Classic Controller Pro.
Yeah, if you look at the bottom of it, that's where I was going. It looks like a Classic Controller Pro also.
Yeah, it's got contoured handles, and it's much rounder than I would have thought.
It's got that weird bump that the Pro has, too, and it towards the when it kind of like goes in on itself. It feels like Capcom said, yeah, we really like that Pro thing. Can you just slap that on a 3DS and we'll call it a day?
That's pretty much what they're doing.
But we mentioned this, but it takes a battery to run.
Yeah, one AAA battery, and I know why.
Because it doesn't connect by a physical port. It connects by the IR.
That's right. It uses the infrared port. There's a
that
weird
is
box.
So insane.
There's
really
a box
weird.
At the top that houses the infrared coder decoder, basically, that transmits the data back and forth. And it actually covers up the game slot, but I don't think there's anything. I mean, you got a game in there. This thing supports multiple games, so the game itself is just under that. It covers it because it has to be a certain size in order to contain the equipment to do this. But yeah, it covers up the IR slot and it's pulsing shit back and forth to transmit that data.
It's kind of a weird situation they've got with this thing, and yeah.
It's pretty hacky.
I hope the AAA battery doesn't die like quickly. Because how you get it off is you take the 3DS unit
well,
out.
Well, it's doing something similar to like a TV remote.
Yeah,
which
I
uses
guess.
An IR sensor transmitter. And so I would have expected it would work a long time.
I'm assuming like there's something on it that'll start flashing when the battery's dying.
So the interesting thing is, you know, we talked about possibly it could include a battery to make the 3DS last longer. That's completely out. Forget that.
Yeah.
In fact, it requires its own extra battery, obviously, and that's to run the IR thing. It's interesting. I mean, the whole thing, it costs roughly $20 when you convert it to American money. It's 1,500 yen. And by the way, I heard from a little birdie. Well, I'll say it's Billy. He tweeted it, I think. He said it's actually surprisingly comfortable. It looks ridiculous. But he said he does actually kind of like the way it holds. And the other thing is, this was announced via the website, via Nintendo's website, not during the conference. But there will be several other third-party games to support this, including Snake Eater.
Yes.
Ace Combat.
Which needed it. Both those games
sense.
Needed it.
Kingdom Hearts.
Yeah, the Kingdom Hearts. They did not announce any first-party support for it, including Kid Icarus, which would really benefit
yeah,
from
it. Yeah, I'm skeptical whether we'll ever get any. I mean, it's something we could have touched on when we were kind of rating the odds of how likely this sort of thing was to exist. It doesn't strike me that Nintendo would have a U-turn on something like, well, these are the kinds of games we're going to make for the 3DS. And then, you know, we get a little way in, then they're like, oh, actually, you want to make this kind of game? You know, they made the decisions they made with respect to the 3DS hardware design.
Well, to be fair, Kid Icarus was the first 3DS game ever revealed, ever shown.
Yeah.
So it's not like they're changing course. I mean, I just think 3D. I think Kid Icarus from the very start was a game that was a little too big for the controls that 3DS had.
Well, that may well be so. I mean, my point is that you know I think Nintendo does not believe that it really needs to have dual stick support.
Maybe not, but it does.
Well, their belief is what matters here. The point is. If they didn't think it at the outset, you know, when they were finalizing the hardware design, all that kind of thing, I strongly doubt they think it now. But the third parties in Japan, which again, you know, you might think, do they really care? Because, you know, Monster Hunter's done just sold all those millions of units on a platform that only had one nub. But, you know, it seems like they are interested because you've got quite a few represented there. You've got Square Enix, you've got Konami, you've got Capcom, and you've got Namco Bandai. So that's you know, four of the big ones right there. So they are clearly somewhat.
It's weird. It's going to be optional in all these games, including Monster Hunter. It's always optional, which I think hurts the idea that the assumption that the second joystick, the second circle pad, would be included in a 3DS Lite hardware revision. I think the fact that it's only third parties, at least so far, and that we know it'll always be optional, it should be optional. It prevents segmentation of the market, right?
Right.
Yeah, I think, again, the key thing is Nintendo, ultimately, they're going to have these hardware revisions designs based around, you know, their games, their profit margins, all that sort of stuff. So, you know, if this can exist in this little, almost like this weird little subculture within 3DS software in Japan, where people are happy with the attachment, you know, giving the functionality they need, then I think they could feel comfortable enough to exclude it from a revision and just let that sort of serve the purpose. But it remains a possibility that they could include it in a revision, I think, if they felt that this was a direction that they needed to go more in, maybe because, you know, they weren't being as successful as they were hoping. You know, maybe if some of these games don't succeed as much because people are expecting a revision to include it in the future, you know, a second circle pad, it could become a self-fulfilling prophecy if the sales are not as strong as they think.
I would say that the games that they've listed, though, so Monster Hunter, Resident Evil Revelations, Metal Gear Solid, Ace Combat, Samurai Warriors, and Kingdom Hearts, they're all games from the console space, and I wonder if that's going to be the purveyance of...
I mean, what you've mentioned there in terms of, you know, these console downport kind of issues, you know, old games, I mean, very much lends itself to some of these Japanese third parties. You know, they had games that were for, you know, non-Nintendo systems in the past, and they're kind of bringing them to this Nintendo portable now and all this kind of thing. For Nintendo themselves, their console games are going to be on the console. They're going to be on Wii U in the future. So I'm not sure that you're going to have a sort of Nintendo feeling like they've got that many games that would take great advantage of this.
No.
Kid Icarus notwithstanding. So, again, I think that means that the revision containing a second circle pad is by no means inevitable.
All right, well, let's move on from that. Anyway, it's an interesting development. Some other games that were announced at the 3DS conference include Mario Tennis, which we did confirm later is developed by Camelot, so that's pretty exciting. Probably have some RPG elements to it.
Very cool.
Yeah, you look at the trailer, it looks exactly like the GameCube game, pretty much. So you wonder if they're going to have gone and put in the sort of RPG elements you expect from a portable Camelot Mario Sports game into that kind of GameCube skeleton of a game they've already got.
Yeah, I think Mario Tennis is a great fit for the platform, and again, I will be primarily interested in it if they do the story mode with the RPG stuff, because I think I would love, I've never actually played one of those portable Camelot games.
They're really good.
You know, I jokingly called them Golden Sun Tennis, but
there are
some elements gameplay-wise, physically, how they feel, that aren't that indistinct.
Yeah, I did play the Mario Golf one on GBA, and the use of the sort of emoticon style stuff that Johnny is so averse to is very.
Yeah, okay. Maybe I don't want this.
Well, I mean, 10 out of 10, so you need to want it.
Absolutely, man. I don't think you have a choice.
But yeah, so we also got a new Fire Emblem announced, and that looks really nice. It's funny, I was watching a trailer for it. The actual strategy part looks very similar to other Fire Emblem games, but
it looks bad.
It looks like a kind of a GBA or a DS game. But once the enemies battle, if you have the battle animations turned on at least, the 3D graphics of the units encountering each other are gorgeous.
Yeah. Well, there is one piece of interesting gameplay that I didn't pick up when I watched it live, but watched it when I saw it the second time, is that you can have 2-on-1 fights.
Hmm.
So there are multiple times in that trailer where two characters are fighting one character.
I wonder how you would set that up on the map.
I'm not sure, but it's interesting, say the least.
Yeah, I could also see a lot of like Street Pass type things for Fire Emblem that would make sense. For Mario Tennis, too, for that matter. But
oh, for Mario Tennis, it definitely makes sense.
Yeah.
It raises the question whether it will get localized, of course, because we've already had one DS game that seems like it won't get localized.
It's been a bit rocky in that regard.
Yeah, but this is the first one for 3DS.
Yeah, it's definitely. The odds are better, don't get me wrong, but
I think it's a pretty safe bet.
I do hope, though, that the overworld gets a little bit of an upgrade, because that it looks dreadful. and the dichotomy between that and then the in-battle animation is just too much.
Mm-hmm. Well, we also saw some Shinrai Camera. This is apparently a spin-off of the Fatal Frame series.
Yes.
But it's using a lot of augmented reality stuff.
So that's actually kind of an interesting trend we saw, because there are 3 or 4 AR-featured games that were on this event.
Yeah. Kid Icarus had a bunch of stuff. There's a big trailer where it looks like Kid Icarus either comes with a bunch of cards or maybe you buy them separately.
Remember, the cards were at E3.
Yeah,
but we didn't really know what they were for.
Well, no, we knew what they were for. They put two cards next to each other and they battled.
Yeah. But you also apparently scan them into the game, and they let Pit use weapons and things like that in the game.
I mean, that makes sense. Maybe they're going to hand them out at events and stuff. I mean, there was, and we'll get to it, there was a Square Enix game that used it too, that used AR cards.
But yeah, Shinrai Kamura, Fatal Frame, it doesn't interest me that much, and I kind of watched the trailer just for the sake of completion, and I actually thought it looked super interesting, especially compared to all the really lame DSiWare augmented reality ghost hunting games. You know, there's several of those that look terrible.
No.
And this stuff looked really interesting. I don't understand exactly how it's played, but the idea is that, you know, because it's based on Fatal Frame, you are taking pictures of ghosts, which plays into exactly what you're, you know, what you're already using the 3DS for when you do augmented reality. Mm-hmm. And it does a lot of the kind of warping stuff. I mean, at one point, they were pointing the camera at a book. And I don't know if this is a book that comes with the game. That would be really cool. Or maybe it was just any generic book. But ghostly words started appearing on the page, which is a really nice atmospheric use of augmented reality. And then the whole thing starts to warp, kind of like the dragon, you know, the 3D target shooting.
So it's Ghost Raiders, basically, is what you're telling us.
Ghost Raiders.
There was a bit of Face Raiders in it. Obviously, it's more somber. And
You don't think that's a super serious title, huh?
But I thought it was actually surprisingly cool. And augmented reality is something that I think is pretty gimmicky and hasn't been shown to be, you know, a good force in the world of game design. This looked like it might actually be finally doing something good with it. So I thought that was pretty cool. I think it's very questionable whether this will be released outside Japan.
Probably not.
Yeah, I doubt it.
I mean, if it's really cool and it actually does neat things, I could see one of the small publishers picking it up.
That'd be cool.
Your Xseeds or your Rising Star or whatever.
All right, so finally we come to James's favorite, Bravely Default Flying Fairy.
Which has got the worst name in the history of names.
Yeah,
it's top in Infinite Undiscovery for you.
Yes, it does. It does, actually. Because it's probably the only game I could think of that starts with an adverb. But it's Square Enix RPG, as they called it, a old school, their words, not mine, RPG that they said is inspired by the Square Enix lineage. But like I said, it does use AR cards somehow. I don't know how much they discussed it. All we saw were some trailers that looked really nice.
The footage is beautiful.
It is
really
probably
beautiful.
The most attractive. If that's really what the game looks like, it's probably the most attractive 3DS game we've seen. Because it probably looks better than pretty much anything on Wii. Or the majority of stuff on Wii, at least.
Yeah, everything looks hand-drawn on it.
It does, and that's kind of what was weird about it. Like, I'm not sure if it's real, but it looked like people were interacting with it, so I don't know. But then again, they didn't really talk about what the game's like anyway, so it's kind of a moot point.
But it's one to watch. I mean, it's pretty exciting, even despite the horror, you know, that name. In the West, it'll be completely different.
Yeah, I mean, like the first half, you're like, okay, this is banking related, apparently. But then you get to the second half, you're like, you know what, no, I'm hands off. I'm not even going to postulate.
Well, and it was weird because the first part of the trailer starts off with the artwork of the girl with like a skirt up to her butt.
Yeah.
And it slowly pans up her legs, and I'm just like, what is this?
What are you doing?
Yeah.
Now, keep in mind that this wasn't particularly long in the press conference after we had Love Plus Plus, so it was, we're already kind of in that place at this moment. But did we mention this press conference was really, really for Japan?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things. There's a couple of games, you know, that the lesser of the most interest to us. But, you know, sort of picking up on a thread that Chris Kohler was kind of emphasizing last time, expanded audience games. Nintendo haven't necessarily been hitting them that hard with the 3DS and all that, you know, and it's kind of weird considering they had such success before. Mm-hmm. But you did have a couple of sort of big hitters that they brought back here. So you had the Tomodachi Collection sequel.
Yes.
And you had the Girls Mode game. Both of those have been big, big sellers in Japan. You know, expanded audience. There was quite a focus, dubious sort of objectifying games notwithstanding. There was a focus on girl gamers, you know, how, like, well, currently the 3DS is more male-dominated than the other platforms. We want to change that with the completely not stereotypical pink DS, 3DS. Yeah.
To be fair, most of the audience hasn't made the jump, regardless of demographic.
Yeah, so I think the point is that question in terms of how they're going to kind of crack the expanded audience not in the West is still completely sort of unanswered. But
right.
There was a similar thing with DS originally, you know, that a lot of this stuff started in Japan and it kind of worked its way over quite a bit later with the Western markets. So we, I think given the fact that Vita's coming out sooner in Japan and Nintendo's kind of gearing a lot of their resources to preempt that, to get out in front of that, and also, of course, just the fact that portable gaming is relatively quite a bit bigger in Japan anyway, we might actually be seeing that sort of lag that we had with the DS in terms of it, you know, its takeoff and certain kinds of games coming over. It might actually be worse this time, I get the feeling. You know, that the markets of Japan and the West are only getting more sort of divergent, and that the 3DS might be a far bigger success in Japan than it is in the Western markets for some months to come.
So you're saying there's a chance we might still get our Love Plus Plus game, maybe?
Just a couple of years from now. We'll be ready for it in a few years.
Save me the exchange rate.
I don't think I would ever be ready for that game. Ever. Was there anything else?
That covered the major announcements.
There were a lot of... I mean, they had that Be Real trailer. A lot of Square Enix representation, which makes sense because this is very Japan. Yeah, they had the Theater Rhythm.
Theater Rhythm looks okay, actually. They had one of the love songs, maybe the one from Final Fantasy VIII or X. That looked miserable to play through. But then they showed the stuff with like the battle theme from Final Fantasy I with characters fighting Ultros from Final Fantasy VI, and you're playing this Elite Beat Agents kind of thing on the bottom screen. I thought, I would play this.
It was weird. The game, I described it like this. The game goes from me having to play this game to me having to not play this game to having to play this game again during the course of that trailer. And I hate Square Enix for it.
It looks like there might be parts of it that are really bad, but there seem to be some parts of it that look really good.
The dance scene in Final Fantasy VIII is one of the most reviled things in that series. Why they felt the need to bring it back for more derision, I can't begin to comprehend.
It looks like the gameplay is actually different for the slow songs versus the fast songs.
I think there's different difficulties as well.
Yeah.
All right, well, that wraps up our... what was supposed to be a very brief rundown of the 3DS conference and all the news that came out of it. So now we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll have new business. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with a pair of hands-on impressions articles by Aaron. First of all, the Super Mario 3D Land for the 3DS, of course. The upcoming 3D Mario game that plays like a 2D Mario game, as Nintendo's now been very clear it wants us to believe. And also Zelda Four Swords Anniversary Edition, the upcoming DSiWare download game, free to commemorate Zelda's 25th anniversary at the end of September.
Which we found out is more than just the old GBA game.
And James, where can you find out about all the new content they're adding?
You can find out about all the new content on a preview written by Danny about Zelda Four Swords Anniversary Edition, which lists out all the new content in the game. We also, on the preview front, have a preview from Josh from Harvest Moon, A Tale of Two Towns. I don't know which version it is, but since the DS and 3DS versions are essentially the same, it's irrelevant.
Speaking of games that are not rehashed at all and are incredibly unique every time they come out, Cooking Mama! Outdoor Adventures, we have a preview by Nate. And also, we have a preview from Andrew, Bit Trip Complete for the Wii.
Yeah, that's the version that adds online leaderboards and new challenge levels for every game in the series. Sounds like a nice package if you haven't already bought them all from WiiWare like I did.
Yeah, I have not bought any of those, so that sounds like a pretty good deal to me.
Oh, John, sure thing. Get this.
Mr. Atari, he should be all over.
Yeah.
All right, we've got a blog from Pedro about the Star Fox 64 promo video, and it is a pretty exhaustive rundown of this legendary promotional video. It was a VHS tape, and I remember it very fondly. I was very excited the day I got that tape in the mail, so you can read all about it in Pedro's blog. And finally, we have an excellent, amazing feature called Celebrate 10 Years of GameCube with NWR. This feature includes the entirety of the Planet GameCube Japan Experience 2001 CD-ROM, which I once reviewed for the website, even though I was a staff member.
Conflict of interests?
So if you've ever seen the PGC E3 2002 DVD, this is basically the precursor. We learned a lot about how to do that stuff with the 2001 Japan CD. A lot of video content of Billy and his friends back then. Fran Mirabella from IGN is on there, I think. It's got all the coverage of TGS, of Space World from that year. Actually, the first time they showed Wind Waker and Mario Sunshine was at that show, so you can kind of hear the oohs and ahs from the crowd. And then also the entire saga of Billy standing in line in Akihabara to buy one of the first GameCubes in the world. If nothing else, you really should check this thing out. It's very cool. But of course, we've got a lot of other content, tons of news from TGS and the 3DS conference, a lot of stuff for you to check out over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Okay, now it's time to move on to new business. And Greg, since you weren't here last week and you have a new 3DS game to talk about, why don't you go first?
Yeah, well, first of all, though, I wanted to follow up. My quest for perfection in Rhythm Heaven for Wii is over. I've done it. So take that, Belichick. It can be done.
Nice.
And it was a lot of fun. The thing about getting those perfects is on the longer ones, the longer remixes, you really do feel the pressure a bit to, like, you know, to, like the tradition of Rhythm Heaven, the final song is like a sort of grand medley of every song in the game. So as you can imagine, again, towards the end of that, and you've hit everything spot on, but one slip. You know, it's thrilling, actually. It really is. You do get a weird little reward for it, which is a sort of endless score attack mini game thing, but that wasn't really the goal. So that is well and truly behind me now. But yes, I do have Star Fox 64 3D, which apparently the fact that I've played that before, my purchasing of this game is some sort of risible act of profligacy, according to you guys from last week.
I'm surprised because you have a reputation as a very thrifty gamer. And this game, although from all accounts, is done really well, it does seem a little hard to justify in a financial sense unless you just are used to paying full price for brand new games all the time anyway.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a few factors in it. I mean, first of all, for me, this was much more, I mean, I was happy to have Ocarina of Time 3D as a gift for my birthday. This is the one I wanted to buy all along in terms of the two remakes, and that really comes down to my love of the game. And the fact that the ability to play it portably with the visual upgrades, with the save feature, with the score attack mode, all that sort of stuff, that's very appealing to me. I mean, Star Fox is one of those games that I love a lot, Star Fox 64, but I haven't really touched it in years just because it's not something you've got to get around to.
So you did not play it on Wii?
No.
Virtual Console?
I did not, no.
Okay, I did, and that's another part of why I'm not jumping at the chance to spend a lot of money to play it again.
Sure, yeah, I mean, because that offers a certain graphical upgrade just with the sort of up-resing.
It does a little, yeah, yeah.
But what it doesn't offer is like a suspend feature or anything like that, because N64 games don't have that.
Sure.
I never needed that. To sit down and play Star Fox for an hour is really not a burden on my schedule.
I know what you mean. It's not a long game or anything, but for me, I could remember just times in the past where that happened, you know, and I was in the middle of it, and I just, I got to do something else.
Hit pause.
You got to switch it off, and you got to, no, I'm not. But don't forget, my Japanese N64 or whatever else, they run on a step-down converter, which gets disturbingly hot when it's been left on for a while. I've taken some of the playthroughs of stuff like Link to the Past, and you could have fried an egg on that block. So I am not going to risk any electrical fires in my house for the sake of my Star Fox progress. So this
is lack of devotion right there.
Well, you know, when it was A Link to the Past originally, I was perfectly willing to burn the house down. But this is much, much more convenient than any of that kind of stuff. And you know, for me, of course, it's also the first time I get to experience the game in English. I had the Japanese version originally, and I couldn't have really got around this in a good way with the Virtual Console, because if I bought the PAL one, it would have had the PAL issues. And if I bought the Japanese one, well, it still would have been in Japanese. So yeah. This kind of overcomes both of those as well. Of course, the voices are not exactly the same, are they? Apparently they did re-record them.
Yeah, like Twin Snakes style. They had the same people record the same lines at just a higher quality, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, presumably they did sound pretty shitty on the N64 cartridge.
Oh, yes, yes.
It just in terms of the bit rate now. In terms of the quality of the voice acting, I think I could sum up my thoughts on it with a quote from Slippy upon witnessing the environmental carnage on Zonis, where he says, "It's awful." Pretty much.
Well, see, I think they couldn't do better,
Slippy,
because the game is almost part of its charm historically.
Oh, it absolutely is. That's what I was expecting.
It's so awesomely terrible.
If they came through with great voice acting, fans would be pissed.
Yeah, it wouldn't be right at all.
Actually, I think it's a shame that since they went back and re-recorded everything, got the original actors anyway, it's too bad they didn't write additional lines for them as kind of maybe for a second playthrough that you get to hear a different script with more corny voice acting.
I think the tricky part would be to write lines that are deliberately as bad as the original
as
ones.
As cool. Yeah. Exactly calibrated to be as cool.
Well, go track down Dan Osen and just tell him to bring back that old magic. You can probably pull it together. Still around. I've
I think probably
him.
My favorite voice in it is Star Wolf, because it's kind of all over the map. Like, there's one line.
Yeah.
There's one line where he says, like, "You're going to be seeing your dad again soon, Fox." Like, he's like a really bad English accent.
Yes.
But then later on, he's like, "Dang it."
Yeah.
When you do an evasive maneuver when he's trying, it is all over the shop. But it's definitely nice to enjoy that part of it now. It just seems like everyone's sort of memories. I have all these memories of Star Fox 64, and yet they feel so different from everyone else's because I just had this sort of bizarre Japanese girl going, "Foxy!"
So you never knew, do a barrel roll.
No,
that kind of stuff.
Do a barrel roll. It was all beyond me. So that's really something you did, especially like in 97, sort of nascent gaming internet kind of stuff, and even really years later where I started to get exposed to what the English version was actually like. But in terms of playing through the game now, the graphics, it's a big upgrade, actually. It's very much larger than the Ocarina of Time situation because they've tinkered with pretty much every aspect but one. So you've got the lighting is very much improved. You've got the textures very much improved. That goes along with the kind of normal mapping kind of stuff. So they add, these sort of imperfections into the surface and all that look really nice, especially for, the levels where you're in all range mode and it's just like a little arena, whereas they were just sort of flat and very much featureless, and that was much more apparent because you weren't just zipping back past everything, because you were circling around in a dogfight shooting stuff. Now you've got some really quite attractive scenery with some of these things, like the pools of water or the ice, in the case of one level, and the Venom has some nice sort of cloud structure and everything. It's got a very kind of Mordor kind of feel to it now, where they actually have a bit of sun coming through a little break in the clouds. It's very much more attractive in that sense. But the one thing they didn't change is the pop-in. Now, the pop-in, of course, has sort of ramifications for the gameplay, because if you could see it, you could shoot it
right
with the enemies, and then if you could see it sooner, you could shoot it earlier, and that makes it easier. So I assume they kept it the same for that reason, that it would sort of unbalance the game in some way in certain cases. But the weird thing is it still applies to things that are more environmental, where you're like, well, surely it would have been all right to have this just be visible earlier, but they don't. They just stick to it. And what's interesting is they actually have two sort of modes. You've got the N64 mode, where it's just meant to directly recreate it, and then the 3DS mode, where they say it's been rebalanced to accommodate the different control schemes, like the gyro. And you might have thought, well, in the rebalance mode, could we not get rid of the pop-in? Because if the whole thing's being rebalanced, then why not? But they didn't. So I'm assuming they just felt like, they didn't want to get into doing it on a case-by-case basis. And if they say, well, we'll just keep that the way it is, and then we can accrue some performance benefits elsewhere to help make the game look as pretty as it does. I don't know. I assume it would be kind of weird to someone who's not familiar with the game, because it looks so nice in every other respect. It's like, what the hell is this sort of visual anachronism generating in front of my eyes? But it definitely looks very, very much better than it did before. And obviously, it is still a wonderful game to play through. I have been getting all the medals. I've unlocked the expert mode now. And so opening all that up for the score attack stuff, which is something I'm really looking forward to. Some of the gold medals that they've got now. So like in score attack, which is separate, you can get the silver medal is sort of where the medals were in the original game. And then they've got a gold medal, which is in some cases like way more hits. I'm like, God, how the hell would I ever get that? That's going to be quite a test. And I think this is the one area, having the score attack mode separate and the convenience of the portable play, even if you've played Star Fox 64 before, might open up a certain element of the game to you that perhaps you didn't explore before. Because I mean, for me, I did get very much into getting all the medals, opening up the expert mode, and then getting all the medals again on that.
Right. I was going to say, like, I already played Star Fox 64 as a score attack game because it was already set up for that. I mean, you can't just go to any random level and play just one level for score attack, but you can play a run through the game as a score attack, and it actually pretty much encourages you to do that anyway, so I already always did that.
It does, but what I imagine is that, you know, back then when we played that game, especially me being an import gamer, it's the only game I had for quite a while, I was willing to sit there and play through that game the many, many, many times it took to learn the levels, to understand when the enemy formations are going to come out, you know, where it's best to pinpoint a particular enemy to get that hit bonus when you destroy a group of enemies all at once, all this kind of stuff, to get to that point where I could do all the medals and all that. Now, some people have played it on the Virtual Console, or maybe they played it on N64 when they had a bunch of other stuff to play, etc., etc. May not have been the case. The cool thing about this is now with the score attack mode is, say for instance, there's a particular level that you kind of feel like, look, you know, I've got a lot of these other medals, I just want to focus in on this one to learn it so that I can get the score required. You can do that now. You can just go to score attack, play it straight away over and over again to get everything down. And then take that into the main game. And then when you play through it and you get to that level, you're prepared. You just do it. The problem I had when I was a kid was that, you know, I had to play through levels that I'd already got the medal, already done everything on many, many times just to practice what I wanted to practice. You know, and so that's the sort of thing that could have been, this convenience could have been on the original cart. For instance, Sin and Punishment does this. It lets you, a lot of treasure shooters, they let you practice levels once you've sort of got past them as preparation for then helping you to make progress in the future. But it didn't. The original Star Fox 64 didn't have that utility in it. So I think if anybody kind of got put off by that in the past, it's going to be a lot more accessible to them now because you could just go to the specific level you need to sort of brush up on and get better at it. Take that in, and then very quickly you can rack them up and try the expert mode, which for me, I do feel like the expert mode is like the real mode in many ways because, I mean, it's so forgiving. I kind of forgot, really, probably because I remember playing the expert mode more. I forgot how forgiving the original mode is in terms of your wings not breaking off. Mm-hmm. You know, you can just crash into stuff left, right, and center, and they won't break off. And the important thing about that is it means you maintain your firepower. And some of those bosses go down very quickly with the maximum lasers. I mean, like the Andross, all sorts of stuff just dies almost instantly. And of course, that takes away from a lot of the game. You can't really appreciate the attack patterns of the boss if it's dead within a matter of seconds. So I think it's kind of worth unlocking the expert mode just to kind of see the game. I kind of feel like perhaps the expert mode was where it was set at one point and they thought, oh, this is too hard. Let's make it easier and then unlock the harder difficulty. Because it's just, it's so forgiving. I think it's too forgiving. You know, it doesn't, you know, for instance, just the principle of flying, you know, well, of avoiding obstacles and avoiding enemies, it's not really reinforced in the original mode because there's practically no penalty for it apart from a bit of health loss, which can usually be recovered quite quickly. Whereas if you lose a wing, you know, you're flying all wonky, you're firepower's back to crap again. It's much more difficult. So you have to be a lot more conservative. You can't be so cavalier about racking up those hits and all that kind of stuff. So I think the expert mode is very much worth getting into to see how the game kind of hangs together in a more meaningful way.
All right. Well, that's a lot of Star Fox talk. Why don't we move on? Because James has something that's maybe even more interesting and exciting to hear about.
Maybe.
just set me up for that, huh?
For me, it's far more interesting.
Oh, slam. So I went about the business of importing Xenoblade Chronicles because Nintendo of America is jerks, and have proceeded to be playing that for the last, say, a week today, and I'm at 27 hours of gameplay at this point, which is proven to be problematic for me personally in my sleep cycles.
Oh, whatever. Like, you care about that anyways.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mr. 4 hours a night.
Something along those lines of this week, yeah. So, briefly, if you're wondering if this is a game you should import, the answer is yes, if you can get it, because it is very good.
The stock issue is the question at this point, I think, more than anything.
I'm not sure how it compares online to brick-and-mortar retailers. I would imagine that online retailers who ship internationally are getting slammed pretty hard.
Yeah, that's an additional strain, but so what I've observed with some of the games, I haven't got the most, you know, games retailers around me, but you know, there was one point where you could just get the bundle, the 50 quid, what you have. There's one sort of chain of retailers that stock that, but they pretty much have all the game stores in the country, so probably plenty of people might have been in that circumstance, but yeah, I mean, at this point, basically, it looks like it sold out, its initial allocation, to the UK anyway, which I think we had unconfirmed numbers that suggested it was going to be about 30-odd thousand or something.
Which is a very small shipment, to be honest.
Yeah, I think they were expecting pretty limited sales. So some of the stuff that's been in this category before, in terms of just like stuff that Nintendo of Europe has brought over from Japan specifically, like Face Training or Glass Window or Disaster. I mean, they have sank without a trace, whereas this actually did penetrate the top 10 in the UK before it exhausted its shipment.
It is difficult to stay in the top 10 if there are no copies to sell.
Yeah,
indeed. I think it's worth noting that, first off, I want to ask Greg, I mean, for a Wii game in particular, would there be a different version for the rest of Europe or just different packaging?
It should be just different packaging, I would assume.
Okay.
Typically, the Wii games will have the 5-in-1 logo on with the 5 languages.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, this one does have the 5-in-1 logo on it.
But the other thing is, because you do have a lot of people importing from America, they're going to be importing primarily from UK retailers because they want... I mean, for instance, one of the things I was concerned is... and I have placed an import order as well. We'll see. I mean, it's on back order, so I haven't actually been charged yet. It hasn't shipped yet, so we'll see how long that takes. But one of the things I wanted was to see James. I didn't order it until James got his copy because I wanted to make sure it actually worked. Because I wanted a website that was in English that would take my American credit card and that would be pretty clear about what the shipping was going to cost. And you know, so I think most people like me and like James ordered from UK retail websites in order to import this. So there are probably a lot of German packaging copies and stuff like that, but they might only be available in online stores that are more difficult to navigate and more difficult to use an American credit card. And, you know, and a lot of stores just won't ship overseas, period. There's that as well. But I think that might actually be driving it. So I don't know that the game is actually sold out Europe-wide. I think it's probably only sold out in the UK, and I think that's a factor, is because the importers are primarily using UK websites.
I think that's probably all very reasonable. The only information I've seen is that I think at one point in France, Xenoblade, the two SKUs, the non-classic controller SKU and the bundle SKU, were both in the top 10. For a few weeks.
That's kind of messed
up. So there's some suggestion that it sold, you know, perhaps above expectations elsewhere as well, but we haven't really got
that. That's the Quebecois. That's also the Haitians ordering those copies.
Real quickly, before I convince people they want to buy this game, I want to talk about briefly the process of being able to play it, since it's not super intuitive.
Okay.
Well, recently there was the Wii hacking group. Well, one of the Wii hacking groups released a thing called the Letter Bomb Hack, which just requires you have an SD card. Previously, to install the Homebrew Channel, you had to have a game that had an exploit. This thing actually, you tell this website your MAC address for your Wii, which you can get from your menu, and it generates these files you drop on the SD card, put it in your Wii, and then when you go to the message center on your Wii, there'll be a letter with a bomb logo on it, which I'm still not sure how the hell they pulled that off. you click on that, and then it launches the Homebrew Channel installer. That's it. You don't have to own any games. You don't have to know any of the weird exploits. And so far, Nintendo hasn't patched a fix for that. So that's really easy. You install the Homebrew Channel. Then you create a folder on your SD card with a subdirectory. I believe it is apps is the directory you have on there. So it's the SD card name slash apps. and then you drop an installer, and you could search for this, the Homebrew browser. You can find it online. It's pretty easy to find. You drop that on there. You put that into your Wii, and then you go to the Homebrew channel. The Homebrew browser will show up because anything in /app shows up on the Homebrew channel. You pick that, and from there you can download any number of Homebrew apps directly on the Wii. So you don't have to put them on an SD card. It puts them on there automatically. It's literally a browser of Homebrew that's been registered with this thing. And from there you get the Gecko OS booter. Download that. You launch that. You can play the game. It's not super intuitive, but it's basically three steps, and none of them are all that bad once you figure out what you're doing.
Yeah, and there's plenty of guides online, too, yeah, that if you want it in writing.
Yeah, and at least you have the names of apps to Google search now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what we should be clear here is you can do this without pirating anything, without doing any... All of this is legal.
Soldering anything. I remember back in the days.
In fact, the Gecko OS launcher, which all it does is launch region-free games, will not launch pirated discs explicitly.
There you go.
It will only launch retail copies.
Yeah, and it, you know, I mean, in turn, we're not talking about like downloading the game itself and trying to play some cracked version of it. Fuck that, man. Buy the game legitimately and import it, and you can use this stuff to play your real, legit copy of the game. I mean, there's nothing wrong with doing this. It's importing. It's basically just like getting a Switch soldered onto your GameCube so you can play.
But a hell of a lot easier.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot easier. Yeah, I mean, that used to, I think I spent $70 to have my GameCube region free back in the day. So N64 was a little easier with the cartridge. But I mean, in other words, this is a software version of buying like a converter cartridge for your Super Nintendo or your N64.
There we go. So there was a game I was going to talk about. So basically, the game, if you've been totally in a cave, it takes place on the back of one of two giant golems who at one point fought each other to the death, and now people live on them. They refer to as one is Bionis and the other is Mechanus. And on one, it is populated primarily, although not exclusively, with a race of human-like individuals, and the other it is populated by a race of machines that are referred to as Mechon from here this point forth. And humans live in these colonies. In the game, you go to colony 6 and 9, which pretty much tells you that there was a 1 through 9 at one point, and now there aren't. What has happened is, while the humans are stuck on Bionis, the Mechons are capable of flight and have made their way over and have launched multiple offensives against the humans on that particular golem.
Do you think you'll ever get to go to the other golem, the Mechonis?
Yeah, you're going to go. Like many times in the game, I have looked into the sky across from Bionis and seen something of Mechonis on the horizon.
That's pretty cool.
That sounds like it could be potentially very cool to go and explore a completely different world that looks totally different.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're going to go there at some point. Now, what's interesting is that these two things are really more like continents, because they exist on a world, because when you see them fight, because they show their fight, they're in the ocean. So presumably there is a larger world in which they reside, but that they probably don't go into that, because that's going way down the rabbit hole. So the primary conflict of the game is that the Mechanus come over and begin destroying the Homs, which is the human race. And because they're made of metal, people really aren't well equipped to fight them. The Mechanus are huge, and they've been getting more sophisticated lately, and are finding ways to counteract the standard defense mechanisms and are basically overrunning the colonies. And your character and his party have decided that they're out to get revenge for the actions of a very specific leader within that race of robots. So they're basically trying to hunt him down, however ill-advised that is, and essentially end up going from human settlement, driving away these robots. That's the game in a nutshell.
No, that's the story in a nutshell.
Well, I mean, that's the gameplay. You go from place to place driving off these things. But in reality, what you do within the confines of the game is you go into a big space you have to get to the other side of, and then you realize, oh shit, this place is gigantic. And then you wander around for like 5 hours and then realize you've totally missed your opportunity to go into the next part of the story because you spent the last 5 hours swimming in a giant lake.
But you discovered a lot of amazing places and you got experience points for finding them. And
yeah. So
getting a nerd boner over here.
So one way this game differentiates itself from our RPG conventions, I mean, the battle system I'll get to in a minute. But it really, what the game does really well is that it trims the fat on the RPG experience, even in ways that I haven't really thought of historically. Like, its most basic example, you can save anywhere. As long as you're not fighting, you can save. And when you load back up, you load precisely where you were standing when you saved, which is nice, because you can, like, if you are trying to find an item and you kill all the animals that have that item, you could save and then immediately reload from the same menu. Immediately you're back there and everything's respawned, but you're still pointing in the same freaking direction you were looking earlier, which doesn't seem like it's a big deal, but if you think about it, having to save at save points is kind of a pain in the ass.
It is.
When you die, so as you explore the world, you find areas which are named portions of the map, and you also find things that are called landmarks, which are literally specific things that, as one would imply, mark the land, like a tower.
And they're all unique?
Not all of them. I mean, they have different names. Like there's a place where you find these guideposts, and they all look the same, but their surroundings are different. But those landmarks, as you find them, become your checkpoints. So if you die, so if your whole party dies, then you respawn at the last checkpoint you passed. And the advantage of that is you're not punished for the death. And in fact, if you've built up your meter, it's kind of like the gauge meters in Final Fantasy games. If you've built up your meter, that takes a little bit of a hit, but it's still pretty built up from the battle. So a lot of the boss battles, there's a landmark right before the boss. So you die, you immediately step back in and start the battle over again. And in the case of one of them, I filled up my meter by repeatedly dying in his hands and then immediately launched the attack that you use that meter on.
Oh, so you can game it.
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay, and can't you also teleport from one landmark to another?
Which is where I was going now. The landmarks are also a rapid transportation system that you could, any landmark you've seen at any point, you can teleport to it.
Sounds a little bit like Borderlands.
A little bit, but it's a bit more convenient in a way, because it's bang, bang, you're there. That's it. It's good. Two button presses or three button presses, and you're there to where you want
without
to be.
Without the 90-second loading time.
Yeah,
so you don't have to like bind to anything or... Like, everything's just open to you.
Well, no, you have to find the landmarks.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as you see it, though, like, there's no, like, a certain number of binding points that you can use or anything like that.
No, when you reach a landmark, you get this alert that you found a new landmark, or when you reach a new area, you get that same alert. Your characters are your active party is awarded a big chunk of experience for finding this thing, and that's it. You're done.
Yeah.
It's now an active warp point for you when you go to the Overland map. And you can warp from one end of the Bionis to the other, even in the middle of a quest mission where you can't leave the room you're in physically,
but
you can warp out of it and then warp right back to where you left off.
That's pretty cool.
So I had a boss battle that I couldn't beat. I literally warped back to the first town, went to this gem collector where you can take the items you've made and forge them into upgrade gems, warped right back to his chamber and beat the living crap out of him. I was out of his room for like 5 minutes. That's it. Didn't have to walk at all. It was such a relief over the standard RPG conventions of having to deal with that kind of bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing. And so many RPGs, like, okay, like, you may play that game for 100 hours, but seriously, how many of those hours are just you spent walking through some, you know, doing some bullshit errand?
Yeah, well, and actually, a lot of the gameplay in the game comes in the form of these quests you get from NPCs, and a lot of times they're like, you know, so-and-so is really sick, he needs you to find this one type of weed that grows in this one place. I'm going to tell you where it is. Generally speaking, but you have to go get it. So you can warp to the nearest warp point and then walk the rest of the distance, assuming you found this place. Otherwise, you're going to have to figure out where the hell it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then collect it. And in most cases, not all, in most cases, you just finding the item and having enough of them completes the quest. You don't have to go back and hand it to them. There are some cases where you do have to hand it back, and usually it's because some element of story is told at the exchange.
Yep.
But the majority of the quests are just auto-completed. So if your quest is go kill this enemy, you go kill it. Done. It's over.
Great.
Yep.
It's lots of little things that they did to really trim down the busy work of the JRPG.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You should say that just because the one thing that they've added to WoW recently, like World of Warcraft, is quests exactly like that, where instead of having to do the incredibly tedious, okay, I get the quest off of this NPC, I go and complete it, and then come back, and then I turn it in. Just that whole thing, which the whole game has been built on, and which really is just a pain in the ass. They now have the thing where, like, you get the quest, you go kill something, and instantly you get a little pop-up on your screen saying, quest completed, doom.
Yep.
And everybody makes a big deal of that, but really...
It's something that should have happened a decade ago.
Exactly.
it's like once it happened the first time, I'm like, that is so freaking obvious. Why did this never happen?
Yeah.
Why wasn't this the standard from the very fucking beginning?
Yep.
And it just feels nice that way. But I kind of want to discuss the world, because for me, what's happened is when I play this game, I eat up a ton of time. And then, you know, it's time to go to bed. I look and go, I just want to see what's next. And the reason that this world has that experience is because there's so many times that I have had wow moments. I don't mean like wow the game, but I mean like the expression wow. Mm-hmm. Where the first time I walked out onto this field, a lot of the reviews talk about the second area being the biggest thing they've ever seen in a game. And the area they're referring to is called the Bionis' Leg. I would say this area is bigger than all the space of Ocarina of Time combined.
So, James, would you say that when you saw the graphics on the Wii, you said, wow?
No. No, I would not, Mr. Iwata. But I will say that there are moments where they did something with the graphics engine that did inspire that response.
I mean, the screenshots look amazing. And also, you know, I've watched one video of a battle and it looked great.
Yeah, but there are moments where you come across... All right, so here's a good example. There's this jungle that you walk through, and most of it you're walking across these rope bridges, so you're not really in the thick of the jungle. But at one point, I was running down the rope bridges because I was being chased by a bunch of enemies I had no desire to fight at that moment. But when I got to the third bridge, I wasn't being chased. I just turned and looked down the ravine. Mm-hmm. It's so deep, and it goes for so long, and you can see the water coming down, the jungle on both sides. It's stunning. And what I did, I said, well, it's water down there. I jumped over the bridge. Went splashed down to the water, went right down, just rode the rapids down to the waterfall at the end, died. But I found it's a big drop.
That's awesome that you could do that, though.
But when I got to the – right before I went over the cliff, because I'm an idiot, I found a landmark that you would never find in the course of the game. And they actually refer to it as a secret area. And I got a ton of experience for it. And all it is just this island in the middle of the river that you can't even see from anywhere unless you jump into the river and swim to the end.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I think there were a couple items there and one really nasty fish that tried to kill me. So one thing I want to point out about the game itself, though, is there's lots of these little moments where you just find things that are really cool. At the other extreme end of the ravine, it kind of shallows out. And it starts at this gigantic lake that's probably, just to use Ocarina of Time comparison again, the lake is probably twice the size of Hyrule Field. It's just a lake. And if you want to map that whole fucking ravine, well, you better swim all over that damn lake. It would be like if you got out of the boat in Wind Waker and tried to swim between islands.
Schmeh.
It is gigantic. But in the middle of this lake, there's this island you can get on. There's nothing really there, but you get a landmark for finding it. And I get out and I turn and look at this waterfall. It's like if you're standing at the bottom of Victoria Falls, but it's all around you. And it's like sparkling. With this weird translucent hue that this jungle has. That is one of the moments in the game where I thought, they did that on the Wii, that's really amazing.
Wow. I cannot wait to play this.
I swam all the way to the waterfall, which looked like it was really close, until I realized, no, they're just fucking gigantic. They're really far away. But I swam all the way to them and then swam around the perimeter and found some other garbage. But it took me about 20 minutes to swim from one side of that lake to the other. Of just swimming. Like, nothing was happening. I was just doing this really awkward scissored kick swim for 20 minutes. But the whole time I'm looking up this waterfall going, that is really awesome.
So so it looks amazing. Everybody says the soundtrack is great. We're going to –
it is.
I mean, you've done a great job describing it. But the soundtrack in particular is going to be hard to appreciate until we actually hear it for ourselves. But what is the combat like?
So it's kind of passive.
So like FF12 a little bit, huh?
Yeah, a bit. I'll talk about the base case, which is as you're walking around in the areas, there's a path, generally speaking, between the two anchor points of the area. As you walk along the path, you'll see enemies sort of just hover, or potential enemies. Some of them are Mekon, some of them are just the animals that happen to reside on the Bionis. And you can target them with the... I'm playing it with the Class Controller Pro. So for that, you can target them with the L and R button, and you sort of scroll around the creature you want to see. You'll see their level, and then you'll see some special thing like describing if they're hostile or not and what makes them hostile, like if they see you, if they hear you, if you use arts around them, things like that. And then essentially if you want to fight them, this row of icons shows up, and it's two sets of special attacks, and in the middle is this just general attack button. You hit that, and the party then descends upon that one creature and attacks it. Now, at that point, anyone who gets close enough to the creature, depending on the reach of their weapon, will just regularly hit it with their weapon. But you can also select these skill attacks that you can level up and assign. You get 6 or 7 slots to do more damage. There's some strategy in the combination of them. Like, one will inflict one status effect, and then another one, if you hit someone who's, like, if you hit someone who's had break affected on them, you can topple them, which basically knocks them over, and you can do massive damage to them. And if you hit somebody with topple with the special attack, you can stun them for some period of time. You can hopefully chain these up with the AI who's controlling the other two characters. And if you fill up your gauge enough, you can do this chain attack where you pick everybody's moves so you can make sure you get them in the right order and do more damage.
Okay, so there is sort of a way to control all the characters.
Occasionally you'll get the opportunity to, and you earn that by filling up this gauge.
Okay.
Sometimes you'll get events, the quick time button events, where you have to hit B in the right sync, and it'll boost your stats temporarily, stuff like that.
So, and is this is essentially turn-based, though?
No, it's real time.
It's real time, but are you moving your character around and just whacking like in Tales of Symphonia?
You are with respect to the special skills, like backslash, which if you hit someone from behind, you do more damage with. But that has a recharge on it. So there's a certain amount of time based on how many times you've leveled it up that you have to wait for it to come back to be usable again. In the meantime, your characters are regularly hitting based on their agility. How often they hit is derived from that. Now, if you step back a distance, you'll stop hitting because you're not in range anymore. So as long as you keep up on the enemy, you can do that. Now, that means they can hit you too, and there's other things in there. So enemies lock on the character who's doing the most damage to them usually, which means you'll have one character who's getting the living shit kicked out of them while everybody else is just standing around like, yeah, this is great. But the combat itself, a lot of it is it's watching your gauges fill back up or your skills come off of cooldown so you can queue them up again.
Yeah.
But a lot of times you can like bang out 3 real quick and then you just do them in succession. And basically it's pound on the enemy, hope you don't die, try to keep everybody healed enough. If somebody goes down, depending on how much of your gauge you have, you can pick them back up and revive them with some amount of experience or some amount of health. But it's not a super involved combat system.
That's fine. I mean, it's a long game. So
it is a very long game. And what will happen is, as you wander around, if you pick a fight with something, you have to be really cautious about the environment you're in, and there's a good radar system so you can tell how many enemies are about. So like you pick a fight with one like weak enemy, and everybody else around you instantly goes hostile because you've picked this fight, and now you're fighting 20 weak enemies, and they're destroying you. But what in this game that kind of goes with the whole like being impressed by the world are that there are enemies of pretty much every shape and size. There are some cases there's a giant tortoise the size of a house that just walks around. And it's not hostile, so you can get right up next to it and just kind of look at it and be like, hey, what's up? But it's about 30 levels higher than you are at that point. So wow. You want to pick a fight with it, but you know it's going to rape you so badly that you don't even want to think about it. But you come back later and you beat it up. But a lot of times, if you go off the trail, you run into these enemies that are way higher than you should be, who might be hostile. You run into these big, like, one-off enemies. Like, there's a one stage where all of the enemies are these just big motherfuckers who are, like, 50 feet tall and just ripped. And they're not super strong or anything, but they're gigantic, and fighting them is really impressive. And the first time you see one, you're like, oh my god.
Yeah, that's it. There are moments similar to what you're describing, not only in, say, Dragon Quest VIII, where you find some of the key monsters. Later on, you can actually recruit them. But first off, they're almost like optional bosses, and you usually get a special treasure if you beat them. And then also, like in Final Fantasy XIII, when you finally get to Grand Pulse near the end of the game, and you do have this big world you can kind of explore, there are some really gigantic enemies, like big dinosaur-looking dudes who just kind of hang around, and you know they won't attack you, but if you do want to get up in their grill and try to fight them, they're really tough. So it's making me think of these other games, but this is pretty exciting, man.
Yeah, what's fun about in case those big enemies are the first time you see one, it's like life altering because you're just sort of walking down this path. You've been fighting bugs essentially. And then this big motherfucking bear the size of Mount Everest comes walking by, and like he stopped.
You think that's a nod to their previous game, Disaster Day of Crisis?
I don't know. But
can you believe it's the same developer?
Okay, no.
Disaster is the anomaly, though. Not
yeah. I can see this being the same developer as Baten Kaitos. But exactly. I can't see this being the same developer as Disaster. Maybe I can't see Disaster being the same developer as Baten Kaitos is really the issue. But As I saw him, I thought to myself, there is no way he's level 6, which is like where I was at the time. I scrolled to him, level 75. But he wasn't hostile. I'm like, oh, thank God. So I literally just walked right past him. But I stopped and just stared at him for a good 2 minutes. And you can tilt the camera about and look around, which is nice because a lot of times if you look around, you'll see parts of the Bionis on the horizon. Like if you look up what looks like a mountain, as you scroll back, you'll realize that's actually like his neck. And that's just a promontory coming off of his neck. Sometimes if you look out on the other side, you can see part of the Mechanus in the clouds way ahead.
Oh, that's a bit like the halo effect, right?
A bit, yeah.
You can kind of see the curvature of the Earth because you're on the inside of this giant ring that's the size of a planet.
Except instead of the curvature of the Earth, it's a fucking sword the size of Florida.
Oh, man, this sounds awesome. All right, we need to move on, James. We have a lot more time to talk about this and bring it up next time. And I'll be getting it soon. Greg's getting it even sooner, probably. So
it's probably going to be fairly soon. Maybe like a week between the two of us. I'm kind of worried about how long it's going to take.
I would speculate I'm about a third of the way through the game. And like I said, last night I saved right before going into a door to go to the next zone and thought, all right, I'll pick that up. And then last night, I went to go to the next zone and then spent the 5 hours on quests.
Yeah.
And yeah. Never opened that fucking door and was kicking myself the whole night.
It's just making me realize it's going to take me an eternity to play through right. this game.
Like, I could see if I'm estimating the length right, and I think I am, I could see myself hitting 75 hours.
Wow.
Which is nice.
It's been a while since I played a game for that long. Well, it's been Dragon Quest IX, but that was portable.
It's been a long time since I've had a Wii game of this level of substance.
Yeah, well, it might actually be the most substantive Wii game ever made, from the sound of it.
It's any time I cross into a new area, and I'll leave it with this, it's always this, or I'm about to cross into a new area, it always seems like, well, this is the perfect time to save and quit, but I can't because I want to see what the next area is. Except apparently yesterday where I was able to completely content to just complete quests for 5 hours.
That's good. So it works both ways.
I'm ready for this show to be done so I can go see what's behind that goddamn door. Because every time I open that door, I'm always just kind of like, wow.
That's a great sign. Okay, we got to move on. John, did you have anything you want to bring up?
Yeah, I downloaded the trial for Radiant Silvergun because, you know, I didn't want to go all in. I didn't really know exactly what I was going to get there, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, I've heard that this game is held in near mythical regard.
Would you say it's considered to be radiant?
Radiantly expensive, I think, by most standards.
True.
And so, you know, I was very curious. You know, I'm a big fan of Treasure and I just wanted to see kind of the roots of, you know, some of their more recent games. And it's interesting the way it's structured. Of course, the trial is only you play through the first area and you go against the first boss, which is this kind of flying worm who's made out of like gold bricks. And so, you know, the worm kind of winds its way around the screen, and you know, you're kind of weaving in and out of things, weaving in and out of enemy fire.
Yeah, there's a similar boss in Shoot One Up, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it was inspired by Radiant Silvergun.
Yeah, I'm sure. But the main hook here is that, you know, whereas in other games, you know, kind of you collect power-ups and you kind of stack them and you can get better. And, you know, certain areas are much easier if you kind of stack your right options or this and that. With this, you have, it maps, I think, 8 different kinds of guns.
7. I think there's 7.
Yeah, to pretty much every button on your controller. So it's kind of cool because it takes it from the standpoint of, you know, I always think of, you know, other shooters where if you're fighting this boss, like if you described how to beat a boss to somebody, you would say, oh, well, that boss is really, really easy, but you have to get to him with this certain gun. And then you won't have, you know, any kind of, you know, real effort involved in beating him. But if you don't have that, you're totally screwed. With this, it changes that up a bit because you can actually sit there and you can kind of tactically think of how you're going to use each gun, and you can kind of, it allows you to experiment a lot. Like there's a gun that shoots forward and backwards with like a big kind of like spray out of the back. So, you know, if enemies are coming at you from, you know, the bottom of the screen, you know, you switch to that on the fly. There's kind of like the heat seeking one. There's one that sends out a beam in front of you and it kind of folds downwards. So it'll go out and then kill everything behind you.
And then there's the sword too, which I played the demo too. It's on Xbox Live, and I think I'm probably going to end up buying it, but I wanted to read a little more about it, and I would say if you're interested in this game, do not go to the NeoGAF thread because it is grognard as shit. And I read it, people complaining about the most bizarre, minute things, or saying, you know, it's not really as good as Ikaruga, or I've already played it for 9 hours and the trial came out at noon today, and it's, you know, just insane stuff. I read like 3 pages of comments in that thread and had no better appreciation of whether or not I should pay for this game.
I can imagine that. It does get with I've never played it, and I can't now because it's on XBLA exclusively, much to my chagrin. However, you know, with other treasure, like, you know, if you read stuff about Sin and Punishment 2, where you get to hear people complaining about the practice of boss milking for score.
That doesn't sound right.
Again, it's a treasure esoterica can be painful to read, even for people who are well-versed in it.
But, yeah, I mean, yeah.
That's the thing, though. Compared to Ikaruga, the thing that's always interested me about this, because obviously they're linked in many ways, like, Ikaruga, does that have, like, Project RS2 come up on the title screen? Like, it was at one point it was almost implied that it would be sort of a sequel, or, you know, they're two treasure vertical shoot-em-ups. They have a certain amount in common. But the thing about Ikaruga, of course, is it doesn't really have any weapons or power-ups or anything. You know, it's all about just the color system. And you have, like, some sort of element of color in this, like with 3 different colors or something, but then you have all these different weapons as well. So in that sense, it's quite a bit different from Ikaruga.
You're leveling up your weapons as you go through, so you can basically, I mean, you start with all these weapons, but they get more powerful the more you use them. But there's not enough enemies in the game to power up everything equally, and you wouldn't even want to. So the idea is that you sort of figure out which weapons are the most useful in the long term, and you try to manage it so that you level up 2 or 3 of the 7 weapons and keep them powerful so that when you get to the difficult bosses later on, you'll actually have what you need to fit your playstyle in order to actually beat those bosses.
Yeah, so it's always sounded to me like it'd be an interesting complement to Ikaruga. I mean, obviously, Ikaruga is very well thought of, and it's been out on Live Arcade for quite a while. But it does sound like the kind of thing that even seasoned Ikaruga players would be well advised to give it a go.
Yeah, I mean, it's the only complaint I have about it is the fact that, you know, it's graphics, because it was done in the Saturn 1998 sort of weird, you know, 3D is just coming in, so everything's very blocky.
Can you sense that the polygons are made out of quadrilaterals? Is that affecting
yes.
you?
That's exactly how I would describe it.
Well,
the words right out of my mouth.
Not on here. They reprogrammed it, so it's running an Xbox 360 engine, so they're not quadrilaterals.
But that's where it comes from, and you still know that, you know, deep down.
Yeah, you still know deep down this was 3D.
I felt it in my heart more than anything.
On a backwardsly designed system for the time that's also 14 years old.
Yeah,
yeah, that's the problem with Radiant Silvergun fans, is that they're racist against triangles. So that's why I can't be friends with them. But I am probably going to buy this game in a few days once I clear out a few other things I've been working on.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to kick my ass. I mean, it's still, you have to remember, Ikaruga is a game that I really like and admire, and I enjoy playing it. But every time I go back to it, just like we did after PAX East, I'm reminded of how fucking hard it is and how terrible I am at it. Playing this game is going to be the same way. I'm going to beat my head against the wall over and over and over again until I finally get past the second level.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just going to feel like that. And that's okay. I mean, as long as it's fun, it sounds like, I mean, the problem with Ikaruga is that it's so simple. It's so pure. I mean, as you said, there's really, I mean, the game is just basically one mechanic.
Yep.
And so if you're not really into that mechanic, or if you've just kind of grown tired of it, it can be kind of a chore to get through the first couple levels over again just to see something a little bit new before you run out of continues.
Yeah, I think Ikaruga strikes me as being very sort of elegantly designed. But as you say, in a sense, it is a bit of a one-trick pony, whereas this might be a bit sloppier.
But in a good way.
But it's got more, you know, to see. That's why I've been always, I would love to be able to play this. So.
Yeah, they do some interesting things with enemies coming in and then going back into the background, like coming into the foreground and back into the background, and so you have to kind of play to that. So you might be fighting the same enemy, but at one point you might be over top of one part of him, but you're safe, and then he'll go back, and you have to dodge as he comes back into the foreground and go
so,
around.
So, you know, are you advocating for a 3DS port? on that basis. I am.
That would be awesome.
I'd probably pick it up.
Yeah, that would be fantastic.
It would actually, yeah, it would be really cool.
Hey, well, actually, now that they have done the triangle conversion.
They just lopped the side off.
Treasures, bang, well, no, they had to completely reprogram the graphics engine and redo all the art. So, you know, that's a lot of work. And not that Treasure is known for spreading their games across many platforms or doing multiple ports, but because of this game's mythical status and the fact that I don't think it's going to do all that well on Xbox, actually, I don't think it has enough cachet among Xbox players that it's going to do really well for them. I think it's possible that they might want to, you know, amortize that over multiple versions. So maybe we could get something for 3DS or Vita or something like that. It would make sense.
Yep.
I thought the demo was cool. It's definitely more colorful, more zany looking than Ikaruga. And the fact that you have all these weapons and they're, some of them are pretty wild and not very intuitive to use, which to me says that there's some depth there because you're actually going to have to learn how to use it. And the fact that they level up over time, which you don't really get from the demo. But
yeah,
I, all of it sounds like a shooter for me, certainly. I'm just worried about the difficulty of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely it'll be pretty hard. I mean, that first area is fairly challenging. I mean, you really do have to train yourself and, you know, get used to all the patterns. It's the same kind of thing.
Okay, well, let's wrap up new business. I've got a couple things. First off, I haven't really talked about the ambassador stuff. You guys covered that when I was out a couple weeks ago. And I haven't really spent that much time with the ambassador games. I had a similar experience to you guys. Like, I popped in Donkey Kong Jr. is like, oh, this isn't fun. I used to think it was fun, but I don't now. Balloon Fight, oh, this is Joust. Great. Don't like Joust, so don't care about that. Yoshi is unbelievably primitive and simple. I don't understand. I'm not even sure that's a game. It feels more like a screensaver. Maybe there's something going on there I don't understand, but holy shit. The fact that that game came out in like 93 or something blows my mind. They're far more sophisticated and interesting NES puzzle games from years earlier than that. So, not a fan. Wrecking Crew, played it for like 3 minutes. Don't understand what's going on with there. And there's no manual, really. The manual just tells you the controls. So, I need to read more about Wrecking Crew, because I know there are people who like it, and I need to figure out how to actually...
You just have to destroy everything.
You're a crew who wrecks things.
But that's... There's no... Isn't there supposed to be some kind of puzzle element? Is there supposed to be some thought behind what you destroy?
Early on, it's pretty simple, and you're just like avoiding enemies. But I haven't played it for that long. But as I've got a bit further into it, you can see certain levels where, you know, if you destroy things in a certain order, you wouldn't be able to destroy everything. You've screwed yourself. You know, you've cut yourself off from. So for instance, you've got a destructible ladder or something.
Mm-hmm.
If you break that too soon in the sequence, you can't complete it. So that's where the kind of puzzle element comes in.
Okay, I need to give it another shot. Was not impressed from what I played. But really what I've played the most of by far, actually several hours of, is The Legend of Zelda. And I'm now on the 9th dungeon, level 9, so I'm at the very end of the game, although it's a humongous dungeon. It's going to take a while to get through it. But I have really enjoyed playing Legend of Zelda again. And I think the last time I played it would have been on the GameCube disc. And that version of it, I didn't like playing it on the GameCube controller, and it wasn't portable. Having a game like this portable is in particular really nice.
Yeah.
And it looks so sharp. That's the one thing I'll say about the Ambassador games. They look really good on the 3DS screen because they're so. I mean, this is a game that we're used to seeing on a big TV, you know, and it's raster graphics. So when you squeeze that down, it makes it look sharper and sharper and sharper. And the colors are very bold and vibrant, partly because, you know, most of us played those games back on crappy old CRT televisions over RF adapters.
Yep.
So now that you eliminate that, you're viewing it on a high quality, you know, backlit LCD screen, the colors just look better than you remember because, and that's not necessarily just your memory, that's because they didn't look that good in the format you originally played it. It's one of those things, like if you've ever gone back and hooked up an NES with the AV, RCA audio video cables, you'll find, oh, these games have stereo sound. And, oh, the colors are much better when you use a good cable. Because, you know, the TVs I used to play NES on didn't have RCA input, so I had to use an RF adapter, which
just
destroys the signal.
I always had to sort of experience that very vividly because we were importing a lot. You had to use a SCART cable. to and that actually does the picture in RGB. So it looked very, very good. But then if I went to a friend's house and it was through RF or composite and the borders and all, it was like, fucking hell, it looks so much worse. So I had that the effect contemporaneously, but it's very, these things, look, the Ambassador games look very, very nice.
They do, certainly. And it gives me a lot of hope for, I mean, most of these are really early primitive NES games. And if, I had a friend ask about that. And it was like, do you just think they gave us the shittiest games because, you know, they were free? I said, no, I think these are the games that Nintendo was planning to sell first because they're the simplest, they're the easiest to debug, they're the easiest to emulate. And I think this was just the first 10 games that Nintendo had lined up to sell. And then when they decided to do the price drop, they said, okay, well, let's just take the ones that we're ready for and just shove those out the door. And I do think eventually once they start selling these NES games on virtual handheld, they will get to more advanced games. And I'm excited to play some of the more advanced, more sophisticated, later era NES games with these hot graphics, with the suspend feature, with the restore point feature eventually. I think all that stuff's going to be really cool. So this is kind of just a taste of things to come. But I'm not complaining, and I have had a really good time with The Legend of Zelda. And the game, you know, I think a lot of people say it's hard to go back to the first Zelda game because it's obtuse, you know, and it's poorly translated, and you got things that are just kind of seemingly random caves and burning bushes and stuff, you know, just all over the place. But I'd say the really important things in the game, like where you get the white sword and where you get the master sword, there are clues that are decent there that will help you find that stuff. There are these mazes where the screen just repeats until you go in the right sequence, and there are clues. If you really search, you can find clues that will give you the sequence to get through that stuff. So the game, it is obtuse by today's standards, but compared to something like Mylan's Secret Castle, it's not. Compared to Castlevania 2, this is easy to understand, okay? So I don't, and especially compared to Metroid, where there are no clues, period. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just no text in that game. So there are no clues at all, and the visual fidelity isn't enough that they could give you environmental clues. So I think compared to that, even, Legend of Zelda is not that difficult to get through, not that hard to find out. And, you know, GameFAQs is a thing. If you get stuck and you need help, go to that. There's no shame in it. If you've never played the original Legend of Zelda, it's absolutely worth it. And I think once you get through one or two dungeons and you kind of get the rhythm of it and you start becoming more powerful, you know, you get a couple hearts, you get a couple items, you get the boomerang, I think you'll really want to keep playing it. I think you'll get the feel of it and you'll realize why this is such a fun game. It's really interesting to go back and see all the aspects of this game that have been translated to many subsequent Zelda games in really unusual ways in some cases. So I've had a great time. I think this game totally holds up. It sounds great. Music and the sound effects are really good. And it's really satisfying to just run around and kill things with a sword and collect rupees and hearts. It just feels good.
I mean, for me, it's that kind of arcade roots sort of thing that really keeps me coming back to it. Like, it never really gets old for me. Like, because it's, you know, there's so much action involved in it, like even more so than, you know, than when it went into 3D and it became more puzzle oriented.
Right,
like,
right.
That makes it something that I can play over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, the action of it does feel arcadey, but the structure of the game is such that you could never do this in the arcade.
Yep.
It's way too long, it's way too free-flowing, it's way too non-linear, you know. It's about taking your time and being patient and sort of being thorough and just looking for things and going back to places you've been before and saying, did I miss something here? Because you probably did. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't work in the arcade. But in terms of the play mechanics and the way the action feels and how much fun it is just to run around and kill things, you're right. It does have an arcade appeal. So it's the marriage of those two that made it a really impressive, innovative game on the consoles.
Yep.
It's good shit. And now, you know, if you've got a free copy, you've no reason not to play it. Don't be intimidated by this. It's a really, really fun, accessible game, even now, 25 years later. So the other thing I played a bit this week, not as much as I wanted to, but I finally got into Castlevania Lords of Shadow, which I'd had from Gamefly for like 2 weeks without touching it because I've been so busy. And actually, this game, I've decided that when I get done playing with this game, I think I'm going to suspend my Gamefly account for a while until I catch up with other things, because I just, the pressure of having a game there that I'm paying for whether I play it or not is bothering me, especially when I've bought now several other games I haven't had time to play yet. So I think we're getting now to the part of the year where I'm actually going to be buying games as well, which, you know, like physical disc games, which I haven't done lately. So once Batman comes in and Skyward Sword and, you know, all Gears of War 3, maybe all that stuff, I'm not going to have time to do Gamefly stuff. So I'll use that to catch up on the holiday things I miss when spring rolls around. But anyway, Castlevania Lords of Shadow, I mean, Greg's talked about it, and one thing that I kind of lost when Greg was talking about it is the game is so beautiful.
Oh,
really,
yeah.
Really impressive graphically. The artwork and the world design, the animation, it's just super impressive. And, you know, obviously the game bears a lot of resemblance. In some sense, is derivative of Devil May Cry and God of War, and a lot has been said about that. But I think the interesting thing here is that visually, the game really strikes out its own style. And what I appreciate so much about it as I play it, and every time I get to a new place, my respect for the game is just refreshed, because they continually find ways to make a game that, from the description, seems like it should be really dreary. You know, it's Castlevania, you're fighting werewolves and zombies and vampires, and you're going through caves and graveyards and, you know, lonely swamps and things like that. And yet all of these things are rendered in sort of a bright, colorful, exciting way, which is not the case with God of War. Not really. God of War is very dreary in a lot of ways.
A lot of it is indoors, dark, torch-lit sort of areas.
Yeah, and Devil May Cry is really over-the-top Japanese, but it's not what I would call beautiful. It's very gothic-looking, and it's very dark way. I mean, a lot of it takes place in towers, and, you know, it has some of the same themes, but I think Castlevania really is just kind of explosively colorful and brilliant in the way that it's presented. And oddly enough, that makes me maybe have a little bit of graphics horror in me, but that it makes me want to keep playing it. And it makes me want to keep pushing forward, even though the description of the game sounds like it's just too much like other games I've already played. And as you go forward, it does seem, I mean, I'm still early, but it does seem like they're going to keep adding mechanics and new items and new abilities that will change the way that you play the game pretty significantly, including changing up some of the platforming stuff. And platforming is not really much of a factor in either Devil May Cry or God of War. So I'm looking forward to some good 3D platforming out of this. I think it's going to deliver. But the combat's definitely challenging, and it's interesting too. Like, I got in one room, and it was clearly set up as a kill room, and there were some enemies in there. There's one of those giant spiders. It's just really frustrating. I died several times. But there was clearly like an area, like the area that you would go to next, there was like a tunnel. And, you know, I figured I need to kill these enemies first, and then I can go in the tunnel. And the camera is very static. You have no camera control whatsoever. So the camera is set up that the game clearly wants you to fight these enemies. And finally, I just got really frustrated, and I said, well, I'm going to go over there and see if maybe there's a secret item over there that'll help me in the battle. And I went over there to the tunnel, and it turns out I could just skip the entire kill screen. If I don't want to fight these enemies, I could just move on. And I did. And so I ended up going on and beating the rest of the level, and I never did kill those enemies. And the camera sort of leads you to think that you have to, but you really don't. So I think the game is a little more free-flowing and a little more open to playing it the way you want to than I would have expected.
Now, if you bypass enemies like that, do you get penalized in any way? Like,
you just don't get the experience.
Yeah, I mean, you might miss some extra stuff as well. Like, you know, you get bits of kind of like pieces of heart type of deal, things that extend your magic. You know, you've got the light magic and the dark magic. Well, you might not have got that far yet, but
I don't have the dark yet.
Yeah, you've got two kinds of magic you use, and you've got a capacity for that. So there's lots of little kind of nooks and crannies that you could poke around to find stuff like that. But of course, yeah, sometimes you'll have to fight enemies for it, and maybe in that moment you think, I could do without this. So
yeah,
like you said, the camera will generally guide you like where you should be going just to proceed. But if you kind of poke around, because it's fixed, it lets them hide things. So, you know, if you're of a mind to be inquisitive, you can find extra stuff.
Yeah, and the other thing is, you do have the option, if you skip a battle like I described, you have the option of coming back and replaying that level later on.
Yeah.
Being more powerful with new abilities, you know, having leveled up and purchased new skills. So, you know, and I might do that. If I think the reward is tangible enough, I might go back and do that battle later on when it'll be a little bit easier for me. But the game is not, it's not open world and it's not Metroid-like at all. It's very segmented. There are levels, and the levels are not even really connected to each other in any way. You select them from a map, and yeah. Once you beat a level, you get scored on it, and you save. And then if you want to go back five levels before that and replay it, you can. And the nice thing is most of the levels are pretty short. So you get a sense that you're actually making progress very quickly. Because there it looks like there are a ton of levels in the game, but they're all pretty small.
Pretty long.
Yeah, so if you want to replay a level, it's not a big deal to do it. It's not a big commitment. You know, you can run through that and say, I think I missed some stuff over there. And it's not a big deal if you want to run through it again and do that. Yeah. So I am kind of impressed by it, and I like the structure of it. So I need to put a lot more time into it. But I'm pretty happy with this Castlevania. But damn, where's our 3DS Castlevania?
Yeah, really.
Well, there was a lot of talk about Lords of Shadow 2 a while ago now, in terms of, you know, I think there was the game's composer kind of implied he was already working on the soundtrack for a sequel and all that, and that hasn't been officially announced, at least. So
next E3.
I guess so, yeah, probably, but it doesn't seem like Konami have been forthcoming with anything of about Castlevania at all at the minute, so we'll see if maybe next E3 or something they'll have like a bunch of Castlevania announcements to bundle together to kind of help the some sort of economies of scale in terms of mindshare.
Maybe so. And you know, the next the sequel to Castlevania Lords of Shadow could very easily come to Wii U.
Yo, sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Keep that in mind, Nintendo fans. I think the timing will be correct for that to happen. Not saying that it will, but it's already a multi-platform game. So why not? All right, that's going to wrap up new business, and quite frankly, I think that's going to have to wrap up the entire episode. We've got a lot of content here, and we did have a few emails picked out. We'll push those till next week. We will catch up on your emails, don't worry. And if you are inspired by anything that we talked about on the show today or anything that happens between now and then, we'd love to hear from you. Just shoot an email over to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. You can check us out on facebook.com/Radio Free Nintendo. We're on Twitter. We got NWR_Lindy. We got NWR_James. And I'm @JohnnyMetz with no H. And I think that's all. All right, guys. Thanks for being on the show with me. Thanks for listening, everyone at home. And we'll see you next week. There has been so much news lately. I feel like we've got to talk about it. Since the last show we recorded, we did have the 3DS conference.
We have done a lot of news the last few
weeks. A lot of news, yes. If you haven't watched the website, definitely go do that. You can catch up on a lot of this stuff.
I mean, on the show, we've been doing a lot of news lately.
Well, yeah, it's true. There's been a lot of news going on lately.
We should just have a news segment.
That implies regularity.
Exactly.
There will be news regularly, even if I have to make it up.
I think that's why we stopped in the first place, James.
Exactly.
You essentially making it up by trying to make out the fucking Breaking Blocks press release was the funniest thing in the
Breaking
world.
Breaking Blocks is a testament to human achievement.
Well, speaking of testaments to human achievement, Skyward Sword.
No, don't use that as a segue. Do you hate me that much?
I use everything as a segue. I don't know what you're talking about.
Specificity in segues is the bane of my existence.
Did anyone mention girl RPG? Girls RPG?
What was that? Was it Hitsune Maki or Mari?
No,
game?
Oh no,
that's not. That was this segment is over.
That haunts my dreams.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, this is just kind of some weird Japan thing. I'm like, wow, this is some really, really weird Japan thing. And then at that point, I'm like, oh my God, I think I just dropped acid.
There has never been a game that is more Japan than the Hatsune Miku game.
Yeah.
I think it's just like a lolly version of Space Channel 5.
Talk it's not, that. Though. It's based off, and I'm not kidding, a text-to-speech vocalizer. in Japan that you put in text and then you set the inflections and it sings your text.
Oh God.
Daisy.
Well done, sir.